Welcome to episode 2 of the Heyman Lee Mysteries Resolved podcast. My name is Debbie Simons, and we're going to start off today where we left off at the end of episode 1 with Don Kleindienst climbing into Heyman Lee's car in the parking lot of the Owings Mills Mall on the afternoon of January 13th, 1999. So if you haven't listened to that, I would urge you to go back and do so. And also, by the way, since I don't want to keep interrupting my narrative, be assured that I'm going to have a later episode in which I talk about alternate theories. Let's get back to our story. So you'll remember that the previous night, the night of January 12th, and on into the early morning hours of January 13th, Hay had been on the phone with Don. She had called him as soon as she had gotten home from spending several hours at his house at the end of her shift at Lens Crafters. As soon as she got home, she called him. They stayed on the phone, this is according to Don, until 3 a.m. And I postulate that the subject matter of that call was primarily concerned with Hay's desire to move in with Don. And so, as I said last time, my theory of this case is that Don Kleindienst had realized, for various reasons, but almost certainly partly because of this desire to move in with him, that the time had come for him to break up with this girl. She was pretty, she was smart, she was funny, but she was pushing for way more commitment than he was willing to give. Plus, as we will also be exploring in a later episode, he had probably had an old girlfriend, Robin Kelly, now Robin Kleindienst, his wife of well over 20 years, re-enter his life. And that would have been a further motive for him to break up with Hay. So he has paged her that afternoon at school, which has led to Hay telling Adnan that she cannot give him a ride after school after all. She has rushed off and she has met Don in the parking lot of the Owings Mills Mall. We have been told by LensCrafters employees who worked with the two of them that after they started dating, they had formed the habit of going out and sitting in Don's car together during breaks. I would say that the place where Hay pulls up and stops is that special place. If you look at an overhead view of Owings Mills Mall, you'll see that there are several little alcove spaces, and I would say that one of them was their special place. So, we ended up last week with Don opening the door. I believe, according to the evidence that we have, that Don had something in his hand, a little gift box. We are told that there was an empty gift box in Hay's car. We are not given any dimensions, we're not given any color, but I would suggest that it was something small. And he hands it to Hay, and she opens it, and there, and this is also from the inventory list, is what is called on that list a gold heart charm with a price tag of $119.95 attached. I have never seen anybody try to explain this item that was in Hay's car. I have seen one passing reference on Reddit where somebody suggested that it had been bought at a mall kiosk, but nothing about why was it there? What was its purpose? The price tag is still attached. That means it had just been given to Hay. What is it? Well, my theory is that this little trinket, which almost has to be solid gold for that price, remember it says it's a charm. That means it's something small enough to go on a charm bracelet. This is Don's idea of softening the blow. It's what I'm labeling a breakup gift. Now, I will have to say that my 30-year-old son thought this was a pretty silly idea. So I make no special claim for great insight into romantic habits of young people, although actually I was a young person myself once, but I'm just wondering if this was a suggestion made by Don's mother or even by Robin, then Kelly. Give her a little something. Give her a trinket. All very weird, but Don doesn't have much experience with romantic relationships, as we know. And so he hands it to her. She opens it up, and there's that little heart. And I cannot imagine the thrill that she's experiencing right now. She is sure that Don is going to take their relationship to the next level. That is, until he opens his mouth and begins to speak. And the most likely thing is that he launches into a well-prepared, "It's not you, it's me" speech. Now, I'm imagining this, I'll be upfront here, but it would have made perfect sense for him to say something like, "Look, hey, you're a great girl, and you are smart, and you've got your eyes firmly fixed on your career. You're applying to colleges for next year. You have a career as an optician in mind. We know this." And I'm just not on that same track. I'm perfectly happy working at LensCrafters. I enjoy my work in the lab. Maybe one of these days I'll be a lab manager. And that's really all the ambition that I have. I just want an ordinary life. You and I are going in two different directions. We're on different tracks. And I think the best thing for us to do is just to part ways. I've really appreciated you. You gave me back my confidence after I was cheated on. That part of the speech, by the way, I'm not making up, because that's part of what Don told Sarah Koenig in Serial when she interviewed him. So I hope you'll accept this little gift as a remembrance of me. And when we see each other at work, we'll just act cool. And he expects her to burst into tears. And so he thinks he'll pat her on the shoulder, exit stage right, and it will be all over. Remember, if my theory is correct, he has planned things very carefully so that she's not going to have much time there with him, because she still has to get to the daycare center by 3:15. Whatever happens to Hay happens before 3:15. So that's what he thinks will happen. But the little bit that we know about Hay from her friends, from her family, we know that she is not the kind of person who's going to take this lying down. And my theory is that instead of weeping and just caving in, that she got very angry and started screaming at him. "How dare you? How dare you, after all I've done for you, after all the efforts I've made and this relationship, and now you're giving me this little speech and this crummy little piece of jewelry?" And she throws it at him. The gift box is separate from the charm. And then I would postulate that it's very possible that she slapped him. Why do I say that? Well, because I think any kind of violence like that would have set him off. Remember what I said about Don last time. His father has been violent and abusive towards, it is almost certainly the case, his mother. I have the police records of calls from his home saying battery, abuse, repeated. And so it's not a foreign concept to Don to see a man hit a woman. Now, I want to be very clear here. This is not destiny. This does not mean that Don is fated to carry out a violent attack on a woman himself. But when she slaps him, if that's what she does, maybe it's just the screaming at him that sets him off, he reacts. And what does he do? He does something that produces the first of the two head contusions. They're technically called subgaleal hemorrhages to her head. He draws his fist back and he punches her in the head. Now, Hay is an athlete and she's very quick and she ducks back. So the blow that he had intended to be to her nose, her face, instead lands on her temple. People have argued about this. Could there be enough force to do this? But I think all of this is very wrong-headed. There is no skull fracture. And the skull is thinnest, the actual skull, not the face, is thinnest over your temples. There's no fracture, but there is this hemorrhage. And other people have said, well, you couldn't get up enough force to hit somebody hard enough to produce this hemorrhage. But that's ludicrous. He's not sitting there primly facing forward with his seatbelt on. He can turn completely sideways and he can get in a pretty good blow. And so she's stunned temporarily, both physically and I'm sure psychologically. And then she stares at him and she opens her mouth to scream at him again. And this time he puts his hands around her neck and he starts squeezing. People have said, well, why aren't there any defensive wounds on Hay's hands? It's because she has no time. He gets in there very quickly. And then, of course, she reacts. She starts clawing at those hands and trying to get them from around her neck. And he shows the evidence of this. The independent private investigators who were hired by the HBO documentary, The Case Against Adnan Syed, spent, they said, 3 years tracking down an employee of LensCrafters who was willing to have his voice be used in a recording, although he was not willing to appear directly on the camera, saying that he remembered Don standing with some of his LensCrafters fellow employees, among them this guy, whose initials I believe are S.A., and saying that Hay was missing, so it had to be right after this. And he says, this S.A. person says, I remember that Don's hands and knuckles and wrists were covered with scratches and cuts. And Don said, oh, I hurt my hands working on my car or something. It was a pretty feeble excuse. So Hay is frantically clawing at Don's hands and wrists, desperately trying to get him to let go of her neck. And we know, contrary to what is portrayed in the movies and on TV shows, that strangulation does not take 10 seconds. It takes more like 2 or 3 minutes. And the medical examiner on the stand at the trial gave a pretty graphic description of the process of strangulation. So she's desperately fighting for her life. And remember, this, as I said just a second ago, Hay is an athlete, and she's not a little tiny girl. She's 5'6 to 5'8, which is not terribly tall, but it's not short. She weighs 135 to 140 pounds. She plays field hockey. She plays lacrosse. She's able to exert some real pressure and damage on Don's hands, and it angers him. And so, guess what? He slams the back of her head against the window frame of the door, and that produces the second subgaleal hemorrhage. No skull fracture, but blood pooling between the scalp and the skull. I was quite pleased, by the way, when I went on Colin Miller's blog. Colin Miller, of course, one of the three brilliant lawyers in the original Undisclosed podcast, and he and Rabia Chaudhry have relaunched Undisclosed earlier this summer. But on his blog, evidenceprof.com, one of his commenters said, I wonder if Don slammed Hay's head against the window frame. And that fits perfectly. The location of this second contusion or blunt force trauma is the bottom right side of the back of her skull. It's called the occipital region. And if you picture this very horrific scene, you can imagine that that's where her head would have come in contact with that window frame, that rounded metal edge. So he's strangling her, he's striking her head, and eventually, because there is no escape, she goes unconscious, and in another minute or so, she is dead. Now what? I don't think, and I hope it's clear in the way I've described this, that this was in any way premeditated. This is not what Don expected to happen. And so there he is suddenly sitting in his dead girlfriend's car, staring at her body that has now slumped up against the window next to the steering wheel. What does he do now? And so up until this point, we have some pointers. We have the gift. We have the fact that Hay is killed by manual strangulation, which is 999 times out of 1,000 the result of a crime of passion, an unpremeditated crime, because otherwise you would always bring along a weapon if you had planned a murder. We have the two subgaleal hemorrhages to her head. So we have evidence. Now what? Well, the minute Hay is dead, her body becomes a clock, if you will, and a timer starts ticking down. We know about this. This is forensic evidence. This is not any speculation on my part. As soon as someone dies and the heart stops beating, the blood starts settling in the body in accordance with the laws of gravity. So at this point, she's sitting in the driver's seat. He needs to do something. And you might ask, well, why doesn't he just get out of the car and get into his car and drive off? Surely that would be the smartest thing to do. Well, I think for one thing, he's just panicked and probably not thinking too clearly. But there's also the fact that Don drives a very distinctive car. He has a red Camaro, and he is not scheduled to work that day. What if somebody saw him? I would say that he perhaps got out of the car, moved his car somewhere more out of the way, and comes back to Hay's car. All he can think of is that he has to get her body and her car away from the scene of the crime. So he half shoves, half lifts her body from the driver's seat to the passenger seat, probably puts the back of the seat down so her head is not visible through the window. And then he gets into the car, and of course her keys are right there in the ignition, and he drives to the only place he can think of to go, which is the house that his mother, Anita Baird, shares with her romantic partner, Catherine Michelle, 40 miles away in Bel Air, Maryland. The important thing about this house is that it has a garage. All he can think of is, I'm going to get this to my mom's house and park it in the garage where it will be hidden. Now, as I say, it's 40 miles away. The blood in Hay's body is already settling. He doesn't necessarily know this. He's not thinking in these terms, but we know this. He has about an hour and a half to 2 hours at most for there to be the pattern of that blood coagulation called postmortem lividity to be the way it was when Hay's body was found and autopsied. She's going to be, within that relatively short period of time, lying on her face, flat, on some kind of smooth surface. She is not going to be huddled up in her passenger seat. She's not going to be huddled up in the trunk of a car. She's going to be somewhere stretched out flat. So he drives the 40 miles to his mother's house. I cannot imagine what kind of state of mind he was in when he got there. Now, at this point, we don't know what happened. You'll be astonished to hear that while I have theories, I have some very definite theories about what happened to Hay's body here, I cannot tie this to anything definite except for the fact that she's flat, but also, as anybody who knows this case knows, she has some strange marks, pressure marks on her shoulders. So, for the most part, this reddening or reddish, kind of purplish settling that's uniform on the front of her body is not interrupted by anything, but there are these four strange double diamond shapes. They are sharp and well-defined. I have seen the photograph of the actual marks on Hay's body. I'm not sure that should have been publicly available, but there it was, so I saw them. So the question has always been, what made these marks? And this, I think, is a vital clue to who was involved, not in the murder itself, but in the cover-up. So people have come up with all kinds of theories of what made these marks. Rabia Chaudhry said on her Twitter feed that she had lain awake many nights wondering about those marks on Hay's body. And people have come up with things that make no sense at all. So again, I think this is a Colin Miller comment on his blog. Somebody said, well, maybe after she was dead, Hay was put face down on a mattress with diamond-shaped quilting. But of course, that is nonsensical. That would produce markings completely different from what are there. For one thing, they would be much less sharp-edged because we're talking about quilting on a soft mattress top. And another thing would be that they would be all over her body. So that does not fly at all. So an alert person, somebody who was following the case and was very knowledgeable, tweeted at Rabia back, I believe, in 2018. It was before the documentary had been finished, and said, you know, I think that the marks on Hay's shoulders may be from something called a concrete shoe. And there's a picture of this little widgety thing in the tweet. I have it in the appendix section of my book. I hope you'll buy my book. You can see all kinds of stuff in that appendix, as well as read my theory of the case all written out. So that led to a very interesting line of thought in the HBO documentary, because the private investigators said, recently, we have been informed that that's what might have made those marks. And it's very interesting that Alonzo Sellers, the man who found Hay's body in Leakin Park, and I hope you can hear the quotation marks in my voice around the word found, had worked in concrete for many years. Okay, so let's just keep that in mind here. Don drives back to his mother's house. He puts the car, we think, it would be logical if it's empty, it's just a single car garage, but he puts the car in the garage. Now what? Well, whether or not Alonzo Sellers was there, and one of my theories, which I cannot support with hard evidence, is that Sellers was there when Don drove up, that he was working on the driveway or the garage floor or the sidewalks or all three of Catherine Michelle's and Anita Baird's house. We know that Sellers was a maintenance man at Coppin State College at the time, now Coppin State University. And he was doing maintenance, repairs, that kind of thing around the campus. So he had probably decided by this point, he's in his 40s, that concrete work is for a younger man. And so he had gotten into a line of work that was a little less demanding physically. But he could still do side jobs, and that would make him a little extra money. We know that he was meeting with a realtor to buy a house not too long after this. So what do these little concrete shoe widgets do? Well, as they say in the HBO documentary, they're a tool that you would put on the bottom of a grinder to grind up concrete. That's a little misleading. A concrete shoe is an item that's attached to the bottom of a tool, a big, heavy machine that you would use to smooth concrete out. They would be attached to these heads. If you look at the image in my appendix, you'll see little bent pieces that are obviously meant to fit over something. They spin around, they bite into the concrete, and you push the machine back and forth the way you would a floor sander for a wooden floor. But this, of course, is for a concrete floor. And then maybe you can put a fresh coat of concrete over the top. All of us have seen driveways where the top little, maybe eighth of an inch is flaking off, for instance. This is called spalding. That happens sometimes when there are extreme changes in weather, whatever. And so it just seems very telling to me that the marks on Hayes' body correspond to a very specialized item that's used in concrete work. And the man who's going to find Hayes' body 28 days from now is somebody who's done a lot of work in that line. So let's see how this works. Don pulls in to the driveway. It's taken him probably a good hour. So I said the mall and Don's house or his mother's house are 40 miles apart. Why is he working so far from home when there's a Hunt Valley mall that's only 23 miles away? Well, if you're familiar with this case, you probably have at least a vague idea of why this happened. I will be going into that in detail in a later episode. But 40 miles at that time of day, we're saying this has to have happened before 3:15. But having lived in the Washington, D.C. area myself, I know how early rush hour heats up. So we're going to say it took him a solid hour to get to his mom's house. Now it's 4:00, we'll say. It's starting to get dark. Remember, this is January. So the first thing to be done, I am assuming that Don's mother was home. But we know Catherine Michelle was not home. I'll get to that in a minute. So what are they going to do? Does he stagger into the house? Does he tell her what happened? Do they go back out to the garage and look at the huddled up body of this once beautiful, vibrant girl? What do they do now? They're probably knowledgeable enough, having watched enough CSI or whatever, that they're aware of the phenomenon called rigor mortis, that Hayes' body is going to start stiffening pretty soon, and they won't be able to get her out of the car. And probably, in their muddled way, they're thinking, well, let's separate the body from the car, and we'll hide them separately. So they get Hayes' body out of that car. Now, where do they put her? Where do they put her that's smooth and flat, except for the areas on her shoulders that come into contact with these little concrete shoe, hard-edged metal items? So I thought about this a lot as I was going through this case. And I always had this kind of vague idea that what they had done is taken her out of the car and stretched her out on the garage floor, and that they had been having some work done, as I theorized, by Alonzo Sellers. And so there were some spare concrete shoes sitting there, and they didn't notice them, and they stretched her out, and her shoulders came into contact with these items. And then I thought, well, what about Alonzo Sellers' pickup? Because he almost certainly would have had a liner in the truck bed of his pickup in order to keep his heavy, expensive equipment from sliding around as he drove. If you want to look it up on Amazon, you can buy one of these, and it exact specifications. They can be very heavy duty. That means they would have a little bit of give, a little bit of cushion to them. So you lay it down over that ridged metal bed of your pickup truck. But then, and this was totally accidental, I ran into something else. And all of us who do internet dumpster diving have had the experience of coming up with a totally unexpected search result. So I was actually looking at one point in my writing of my book, I was looking to see, well, were Anita Baird, Don's mother, and Catherine Michelle, who at the time was Anita Baird's romantic partner, but eventually became her wife when Maryland legalized same-sex marriage, which I believe was not until 2015, I was trying to see, well, are they still together? So that's all I was doing. I was just curious. And so I Googled Catherine Michelle, it's spelled Michel-Baird, which is the name she went by when the two women were married. And lo and behold, a Google Earth photo came up. Now, I don't remember where this was. I would not give the address if I did know because it's too recent. This was a 2022 picture, and it was her house, which is a couple of states over from the current address of Anita Baird. So I guess that answers the question of whether or not the two women are still together. And parked in the driveway was a pickup with a camper cover over the bed. Now, obviously, this was not a 1999 pickup truck. It was much newer than that. But I stared at that picture and I thought, well, if she had a pickup with a camper cover in 2022, does that mean she had something similar in 1999? And if you think about it, that would be a pretty good place to stash a body. It's flat and nobody's going to go snooping in it. And it doesn't have to be inside a building. It can just be inside this truck. The big obstacle to this theory, of course, is the marks on Hay's shoulders. What were concrete shoes doing in Catherine Michelle's pickup truck? I don't know. I honestly don't know. But the idea of either Alonzo Sellers or Catherine Michelle's pickup being the place where Hay's body was put does make a lot of sense. So, however this happened, Hay is put somewhere flat and smooth, and her body cannot be moved again for another 8 to 10 hours. That's the amount of time it takes with certain variables, temperature and that kind of thing. That's the amount of time it takes for this postmortem lividity to form. This, of course, means, as everybody and his uncle has pointed out, that Jay Wilde's ridiculous cockamamie story about putting Hay's body in Leakin Park at 7 to 7:30 that same night is absurd. But we know that. By the way, we'll get to Jay. He's another whole episode to himself. So Hay's car is in the garage. Hay's body is somewhere hidden. Alonzo Sellers may or may not be there. Who knows? But he is a fascinating person. He also gets his own episode in this podcast series. What happens next? I'm trying to parse out a logical timeline that is buttressed by the evidence that we have. Well, if Don did indeed drive Hay's car back to his mother's house, he has a problem now, because guess what is still back at the mall? His car. His distinctive red Camaro. And so he needs somebody, probably his mother, to drive him back to the mall so he can get that car and bring it home. Not only does he not want anybody to spot that car, but almost any parking lot, certainly one at a major mall, would have no overnight parking signs posted all over the place. So he cannot leave it there. He must go get it. So let's look at this timeline. He's driven 40 miles to his mother's and his soon-to-be stepmother's house. Now, someone has to drive him back to the mall. That's another 40 miles. And then he has to drive his car back to his mother's house. That is a total of 120 miles. So I'm going to say that when he gets back to his mother's house, it has to be around 7 o'clock. This is kind of an interesting and important time. First of all, we know from the police reports that in the meantime, the Lee family has called in Hay as a missing person, and the Baltimore County Police, who actually do a lot of things right in this case, I don't have a great deal of beef with them. I certainly do with Baltimore City, but they're not involved right now. So Officer Scott Adcock, who must have been on patrol, is sent over to the Lee household, and he's given Hay's address book and her diary, and he starts doing some calling around. And we know that he tries to call the number that's attached to Dawn, and nobody answers. Well, that's interesting. Why doesn't he answer? Well, of course, because he's doing all this driving back and forth from the mall, but also because I think the number that's in Hay's diary is not for his mother's house. It's for his father's house. And nobody's there. Don's not there because he's busy, and I'm assuming his father has a job and is off somewhere. And so Adcock is going to try that number several times, but we know that the first time he tries to call is probably around 7. However, there's another call that comes in around 7, and this is from LensCrafters. Now, Don said in a kind of odd police report, he said when he got home from work at 7, so he's going to claim, of course, that he was working at the Hunt Valley Mall when Hay disappeared. That's going to be his alibi for the afternoon of the murder. We will get into that alibi, of course, very thoroughly. But he says he left work at 6 and he got home, which we assume means his father's house, which, as I pointed out in the last episode, is less than half a mile away from the house that his ex-wife shares with Catherine Michelle. Don says he got home at 7. I'm not quite sure why it would take him a whole hour to drive from Hunt Valley. That's only 23 miles away. And when he walks in, he's told by his father, Don says, that LensCrafters has called. So he calls back, and he's told Hay never showed up for work. Do you know anything? This is a very puzzling phone call. For one thing, it can't have come into his dad's house, or at least not the call that he answered. There must have been a call made to his mother's house. And who might this caller be? Because if you think about it, okay, so Hay and Don have been dating for less than 2 weeks. Hay has obviously been chasing him for at least the previous month or so. And then she doesn't show up one day. Why would the manager call her very new boyfriend? That wouldn't be very appropriate. And then, of course, you realize, well, the person who did this call was almost certainly Catherine Michelle herself. And she knows what's going on between Don and Hay, and she knows how serious Hay is, and she's just curious. Hay was a very dependable employee. I think this was a very well-meant call by Catherine Michelle. I think she thought, where is that girl? I hate to put her down as a no-show, no-call. That's not going to look good on her record. So let me do a little calling around here and see if I can find out where she is. So she tries Don's townhouse that he shares with his dad, and nobody answers. And then she tries her own house, and very possibly Don answers, or perhaps Anita Baird, but we'll say it was Don. We have no information about the content of this call. Don just says, I got a call from Lynn's Crafters saying that Hay had not shown up for work. I have no idea what Catherine Michelle was told at this point. I think it shows, though, that she's totally out of the loop, as is Anita Baird. I mean, remember, this was totally unpremeditated. Anita Baird probably expected Don to come home and say, oh, I'm so glad that's over with. I've broken up with that girl. What's for dinner? But of course, that's not what has happened. So we also have, and I have never been able to track down a source for this, we also have this weird story that Don got home at 7 and he didn't feel good. And so he went to bed and kind of passed out. And he said that was why he missed the call from Scott Adcock. I think that was just cover for the fact that he wasn't there at his dad's house at all. So we're going to say it's now 7 o'clock. Scott Adcock is going to try repeatedly to get a hold of Don. He apparently does not have Anita Baird / Catherine Michelle's landline number. So he's continuing to call the dad's number, and he's not getting anywhere until 1:30 the next morning. And what was going on from my postulated 7 p.m. to 1:30 a.m.? I have no idea. I have no idea. But there are some pretty panicky people in this situation. Don goes home to his dad's townhouse, where I think he typically slept, and he gets that call from Scott Adcock, who unfortunately is not a detective. He doesn't ask the right questions. He just asks Don, do you know anything about Heyman Lee, the girl you've been dating? I was given your name and phone number by her family. And Don says, I don't know anything. I haven't seen her or heard from her since the night before last, the night of the 12th, and I don't have any idea where she is. And that's the end of it for the time being. Scott Adcock does not follow up with, why haven't you been answering the phone? Where have you been? But in reality, of course, there's technically no real reason for him to ask that. He's simply trying to get some information. And we know that another policeman, we are not sure of his name, calls again during the day on the 14th and is given the same answer. Now, if you know, again, I know I keep saying this, if you know anything about this case at all, you know that there's going to be a huge spanner in the works that's going to get thrown into the mix here, starting at about 4:30 on the morning of January 14th. And that's going to be the huge ice storm that envelops the area of Baltimore for 2 solid days. It starts out with rain turning to ice early in the morning. School is canceled for 2 days, and the whole area is immobilized. So wherever Hay's body is, she cannot be moved yet. So we know that eventually Don and his mother, those are the only 2 people who could be involved, come up with an alibi for Don for the afternoon of January 13th. That has been picked apart ad nauseum guess what? I'm going to pick that apart even more. But there's another time, another faked timesheet. We know that the January 13th timesheet is faked, and that's for the morning of Saturday, January 16th. And I've never really seen anybody try to figure out, well, why did they bother with that? I have seen analyses of that timesheet showing it has to be faked for various reasons, which I will get into. But why bother to fake it in the first place? That's a classic case of, as Winston Churchill would say, over-egging the pudding. Why did they bother with this second timesheet? Because I would postulate that Saturday morning, the first day when the roads are relatively clear, but it's not a work day and a lot of people are still staying off the roads, that that's the day that Hay's body was put in Lincoln Park. So I'm going to end it there. And we will get into the nitty-gritty details of this case in future episodes.